The Holy Gospel according to Matthew, the 17th chapter. Glory to you, O Lord. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and his brother John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became bright as light. Suddenly there appeared to them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. Then Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will set up three tents here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." While Peter was still speaking, suddenly a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my son, the beloved. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell to the ground and were overcome by fear. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, "Get up and do not be afraid." And when they raised their eyes, they saw no one except Jesus himself alone. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus ordered them, "Tell no one about the vision until after the Son of Man has been raised from the dead." The Gospel of the Lord. Praise to you, O Christ. Please be seated. Grace, mercy, and peace be to you in the name of Jesus. Amen. So I have a tendency to hyperfixate on things. This is one of the things I've learned about being ADHD, is that if I find something that I like, I will not just learn about it, I will invest a great deal of time about it, I will read books about it, I will listen to podcasts about it, I will research it in every way that I possibly can until I know everything there is to know about that particular topic, which drives my wife nuts. For a while, it was the Apollo missions and NASA, and there are Legos in my office that demonstrate that level of hyperfixation, and the fact that Lego figured out that millennials had some expendable income and grew up on Legos and now could pay more money for said Legos. It's a trap. One of the other things that I hyperfixated on a couple of years ago for some reason was high altitude mountain climbing. Why did I hyperfixate that growing up in Texas, where a little bit of elevation is all that we had? I have no idea. Don't know where it came from. But I did learn a lot about the history of early mountain climbing, particularly in the Himalaya and in the Karakoram Range. And I learned a great deal about the early expeditions to Everest in the 1920s. The British expeditions, once they had seen this mountain, they couldn't stop until they had somehow conquered it. That imperialistic drive to conquer everything and the legends that surrounded it, particularly those of George Mallory and Andrew Irvin, who lost their lives on the mountain in 1924. Mallory was obsessed with Everest, and he had trouble explaining it at times. When he was in the United States doing a press tour before his final attempt in 1924, he was having a long day. It was a lot of travel, a lot of lectures, and a reporter asked him, "Why do you do it? Or why do you want to climb Everest?" And in a very testy, tired way, Mallory said, "Because it's there." The funny thing about tall mountains is that they are very privileged goals to climb. And we talk with great air about mountaintop experiences, but when you dig down into it, and the more I learned about this, the fact is mountaintops are not good places to live. There becomes a certain point as you work your way up a mountain where the human body actively begins to die because there's a lack of oxygen. Or not a lack of oxygen, there's just significantly less oxygen as you get higher in the atmosphere. And so there's a reason why high mountain climbing has such a prestige and also such a high fatality rate. Why this comes to mind for me this morning is that this story of Jesus' transfiguration gets told in 10,000 ways about mountaintop experiences. And I, too, celebrate those experiences. I've preached on those experiences in the past and about how mountaintops give us great clarity and give us the long vision, and those things are all true. But there are deeper truths that come with these mountaintop experiences, and I think it reflects the very human response of Peter. And so it's not the glory of the mountaintop that I want to talk about this morning. It's the reality of what it means to come down. Because there is no life on the mountaintop. If you want to truly grow, you come into the valleys where there is life and running water and plants and animals and rich soil where you can sink your roots. You do not stay on the mountain to become oxygen deprived and frozen. You come down. The vision is great for a moment, regardless of how far up you are. But coming down is always the most perilous path. That's where the most accidents happen, and that's where reality can hit the hardest. And for Peter and the disciples, I believe that's what they are experiencing. We are halfway through the Gospel of Matthew. We took a huge jump between last week and this week. Last week, we were on a different mountain with Jesus as he delivered his Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes and the lessons that unfolded, the lessons that will become the structure of our Lenten studies. You have heard that it was said, but I say to you. Well, we are a long way from that mountain here in the middle of Matthew's gospel. Story has unfolded. The disciples have encountered an entirely different way of existing since they dropped their nets on the fishing docks of Galilee. And it's become more challenging as they've grown closer to this moment. It was just a few verses ago in Caesarea Philippi where Jesus asked his disciples, "What are the folks saying about me?" And they rattle off, well, some say you're a prophet, others say Elijah, some say you're John the Baptist. And he turns the question on them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter, in a moment of clarity, confesses, "You are the Messiah, God's anointed." And it seems for a moment to be one of glory and greatness for Peter. He has confessed true who Jesus is. And then the conversation gets really hard. After 3 days, the Son of Man will be betrayed into the hand of sinners and will be tortured and crucified, and on the third day will rise again. And Peter, still standing, potentially basking in the glow of his great moment of confession, hears the words betrayed, tortured, and crucified, and says, "Whoa, whoa, wait a second. That's not how the story unfolds. This is not what we're expecting. We're expecting you to be God's anointed, yes, but one clothed with power and might, one come to deliver us." So this conversation of arrest and death is nonsense. And he tries to take Jesus aside and rebuke him. And then Jesus turns and very publicly says, "You have your eyes on human things, not on God's things." And then delivers a famous word of, "If any desire to be my follower, they must take up their cross and follow me." All of a sudden, the waters have got very deep indeed for these disciples. And it's not long after that that these three, the inner circle, some have called them, are on the mountaintop with Jesus. And some of the territory is familiar. It's no coincidence that it's Moses and Elijah that show up on the mountain with Jesus. We can trace those lines very specifically in Matthew's gospel as to why these particular folks would be standing with him. It was last week in the Sermon on the Mount that we heard Jesus confirm that not one iota of the law would pass away, that he had not come to dismiss but fulfill, that everything spoken by the law and the prophets would indeed come to pass. Well, the embodiments for Jesus and Second Temple Judaism of the law and prophets are Moses and Elijah. Moses becomes the sum total of the law for the people, and Elijah becomes the prophetic representation. And it's interesting because the ending, or rather the loose end of both of these characters in the Hebrew scriptures, brings more questions than answers. Elijah captured on a chariot of fire as he hands his mantle over to Elisha. Elijah, the one who doesn't die, who is expected to show up at any moment. In fact, still today, gathering for the Passover, an empty chair is found at each table with the expectation that Elijah might be there. Moses, who helped liberate the people from Egypt, who was a wielder of great power in challenging Pharaoh, who dealt with the grumbling of the people in the wilderness, who was the one who ascended the mountain to receive the law, but one who also disobeyed, is one whose ending is not quite satisfactory. He never tasted the promise of the land that he set out when God called him at that burning bush in the wilderness. Some say he was buried on Mount Nebo, overlooking the promised land that he would never see. Later authors began to wonder, since, well, we don't have his tomb, we don't have his bones, was Moses indeed buried, or is he like Elijah? Another loose end, another story not finished. And so the power of these two individuals and what they represent for the mind of Second Temple Judaism cannot be understated. Everything written about me in the law and the prophets, everything that we've got in the books of Moses, everything that Elijah did in his challenge to the people and his challenge to those in power. And now Jesus, God's anointed. All three gathered on this mountaintop. And so we take this being a pinnacle of power and prestige and intention of God on this mountain. Why wouldn't Peter want to remain there? This is it. We've got Moses, Elijah, and Jesus. This is everything that we've been promised. Besides, Jesus just got really cryptic and dark and started saying difficult things like taking up one's cross and I will be betrayed into the hands of sinners and that I will be executed. We've seen that the word that Jesus offers and the actions that Jesus does and the healings that we have witnessed don't always bring about a positive resolution. Maybe for the person that's healed or for those who receive the teachings, but Jesus also has a pretty full complaint box. What we thought we were getting into in Galilee is not exactly what we've experienced thus far. Here I'm thinking out loud as Peter. And so if we're greeted now with the sum total of what God has promised in Jesus, Moses, and Elijah, why not stay here? Why not build three tents and remain in this glory and in this power? It's the danger of mountaintop experiences. They seem too good to be true. And physiologically, when you start running out of oxygen, your brain does really funny things. Forgets that you need things like food and water. Tells you that it would be much better to stay here or that you can go just another step higher. And those are perilous lines of thinking. Much like Peter's desire to stay on the mountain. It's all good. It's powerful. But that's never the intention of who God is. So God has to interrupt. God has to break the fourth wall and intervene. And suddenly a bright cloud overshadows them and speaks for the second time in the gospel. This is my son, the beloved. With him I am well pleased. But now a new word. Listen to him. As if that hadn't been apparent since Jesus began teaching and preaching, that the idea was to watch what he does and listen to what he says. But now the voice of God confirming it, doubling down on it, if you will. Listen to him. And when the disciples heard this, they fell to the ground and were overcome by fear. The glory and the power and the suspension, the lack of oxygen, whatever you want to call it, dissipates and they recognize what's going on and they're terrified. Get up and do not be afraid, Jesus says. And again, they are alone. And now is the hardest part of the journey of everyone who decides to follow Jesus. And I don't say that flippantly. I realize Jesus has a lot of difficult things to say. That whole business of taking up one's cross, we'll deal with that later in the summer. And so when I say this is the most difficult thing that we do as disciples, it's not shallow waters we're swimming in here. Because it's always easy to stay on the mountain. It's always easy to stay in those good moments when the endorphins are flowing, when the dots have been connected, where everything seems like it has been moving to this particular moment. We've got it made. The story's over. Let's stay here. The story's not over, friends. We are invited into the second act, or the third act, or whatever act that we are on at this particular point in history, because the call is always to go back down the mountain. And that's never easy. More mountaineering accidents happen on the way down than they do the way up, because you stop thinking critically. You're oxygen deprived, and if you've made that peak, you're celebrating. And so you stop thinking about the steps ahead because it's still one step at a time on the way back down. Unless you're one of those wild people that think they can ski down a high mountain, which, more power to you. Great pro shot videos. Nothing I'd ever want to do. But it's hard. And we have to remember that one step at a time, one movement at a time, sometimes in this world, one day at a time. But we're never alone in it. Jesus companions and accompanies us down the mountain. Strict orders at this particular point tell no one about this vision until after the Son of Man has been raised of the dead, which only adds to the mystique of the moment. It's only after the resurrection that some of the dots are really connected for the disciples and the movement unfolds exponentially. That they remember what Jesus said on the mountain in his sermon about nothing passing away. They remember the moment of Moses and Elisha on the Mount of Transfiguration. They have now lived the rest of the story and have survived unto the resurrection. And now the pieces start to fall into place. We, as a post-resurrection people, ought to be careful about rushing to the end. We know the end of the story, but learning each step down the mountain is still important. Paying attention to the words Jesus offers, to the shape that his life takes, taking seriously that command, listen to him, is imperative. Because it's always easier to stay on the mountain. The further down you go, the wilder it gets. Life. Reality, joy, sadness, celebration, sorrow, all of it comes rushing back. The full spectrum of what it means to be human. And for Peter and the disciples who had just heard Jesus say some pretty difficult things, those realities start to come back as well. The story might not have the ending that we thought it did. For us, when we feel like we've got all the dots connected and everything's running smoothly, why would we want that to be challenged? Why would we want to be unsettled again? Why, when we're at this pinnacle, do we need more challenge? Because stagnation does not bring about life. It's always about moving back into the valley where there is deep soil and water and plants and trees, what God has created, and where our relationships with that creation and each other unfold. So today we pause for a little bit. And we sit. And it's been a different service. This interesting combination of Candlemass and Transfiguration, which would not have happened without a really ridiculous and destructive ice storm. And yet, a moment to sit and be reminded, a little bit of stillness, some different chanting practices, ways of renewal that we often don't think about. Take it in. It's okay to linger for a little while. Come to the table, receive what God has promised. But know that it's back down the mountain we're going. Know that it's back out into the world with all of its joys and difficulties, because while we're on the mountaintop today, Ash Wednesday's coming. Back into that valley where we're reminded exactly what we are created of and going back to. And it doesn't get any more real than that. But linger for a little while. May this be a moment of renewal, a reminder of God's companion, and a reminder that when we leave this place, we do not leave it alone. That the one who has all power, who has given us life and life abundantly, who has called us to help shape the well-being of the world, that one goes with us to wherever the path will lead. Amen.